I want to give my thanks. I'm grateful to everyone who has come today as well in the past. I think this has been a very successful educational event for everyone. It's a chance for everyone to get together and not only learn something, but to have a little bit of socialization. Next year, we have a very good lineup so far for the Grand Rounds. We've changed the date to the third Wednesday of each month at 5 p.m. Where's Denise? Denise? Okay. I'm fairly certain that that is correct, that we changed it from the 4th to the 3rd. But we will get that out to everyone, but you may want to just save that date on your calendar. That's number one. Number two, I want to welcome our affiliate hospitals in Sugar Land and San Jacinto. They'll be able to listen to the Grand Rounds today. And at the end of the Grand Rounds, we'll ask for questions initially from them, and then we'll ask questions from the audience. And Sugar Land and San Jacinto, your mics are muted, so you'll have to unmute your mics at the end of the discussion in order to ask questions. Next year, Dr. Fabrizio Michelassi, who's chairman of surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York Presbyterian, will be giving a grand rounds. Our own Dr. Richard Davey, who's head of the Methodist Hospital Blood Bank, will also be giving a grand rounds. Dr. Vaughn, who's chair emeritus of urology at Cornell, will also be down here to discuss prostate cancer screening. And also Dr. King Lee, who's the new chair of radiology at the Methodist Hospital, will be giving a grand rounds. And so it's actually my pleasure to introduce Dr. Alan Kaplan, who's going to introduce our guest speaker. Thank you.
At the luncheon session this morning, there was a very elaborate introduction of Dr. Case, and he was very disturbed by this. But let me just say that it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Case to our Grand Rounds. Dr. Case finished his residency program at Mount Sinai School of Medicine after graduating from medical school at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Actually, he and I were roommates in medical school. There are a lot of Nathan Case stories. I won't share any of those with you today, but perhaps at a later time, and they're extremely, extremely interesting. After finishing his time at Sinai, he went to Yale and spent a number of years there and was chairman of the department there for around 10 years. And then after leaving Yale, he became chairman of the department at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and then became dean, and then subsequently dean emeritus. Dr. Case will be speaking today on hormone replacement therapy in the menopausal female, a reappraisal of the Women's Health Initiative information. Nathan, it's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jackson, Dr. Kaplan. I'm going to begin with a disclosure or two. I will say intentionally, I hope effectively, some provocative things. And they do require, because they are highly opinionated and perhaps somewhat radical, they require that I disclose to you that I have absolutely no stock in any company. I'm not on any consultants' board, speakers, forum. The last time I ever had any one of those gems was in 2002. And after I wrote a letter to 6,000 gynecologists to stop PremPro immediately, I never have had another invitation. In fact, it took my old roommate to invite me down here. Here's the format. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on defining the climacteric of the female to give you an idea of what kind of therapeutic management challenges this entity requires. And then I'm going to examine the Women's Health Initiative reports, and there are, of course, many and many, many iterations, and there will be many more to come, and examine them very, very carefully. After all, it is the largest prospective, randomized, controlled study of therapy that we had used for decades. And in that phrase, in that absolutely essential exercise that only the NIH, funded by pharmaceutical houses, could have launched, it is really an absolutely essential document to understand. And what I will try to do in understanding the WHI and its reports is learn some lessons from it that will inform our practice. And I think I lose track sometimes. My wife blames other factors on that. But there probably are 7 or 8 really important lessons that we learn, some very good ones, and all of them of practical import to our care of our female patients in this period of life. So, I will be defining the climacteric in 3 elements: the premenopause or perimenopause, there's an early postmenopause, and then a very extended late postmenopause. The menopause is a single point in the life of the woman. Tons of literature identify it as coming around age 51 to 52. And that has not changed in the last century. Whereas pubescence has progressed earlier and earlier in developed countries and even in developing countries, not so with menopause. It's remained stuck here at 50, 52. Now, of course, there's a bell-shaped curve, but it's pretty steep and well constricted. The importance here is to say that at age 52, a woman then faces roughly 30 years of being hypoestrogenic, of practically a third of her life, if not more. And given the fact that there are now well over 40 million women who are over 50, and because of the baby boomers' tidal wave of population cohort reaches this age in the next several years, there will be somewhere like 2,000 to 3,000 that will turn age 50 every day in the U.S. So it's not a trivial clinical issue. And in my thesis, it can't be dismissed as a natural event that requires no management. That's a failure of responsibility. The perimenopause. Why do I say perimenopause? Because menopause can only be defined retrospectively. After a year of no periods in the right age group, then, oh yeah, I guess that's when menopause started. So it's not clear when absolutely premenopause ends and menopause begins, because there are sometimes periods that come and defy identification of when the turning point was. But there are some very particular endocrinologic features of the pre- or perimenopause. You all are acquainted with the fact that the FSH begins to rise in the mid to late 40s, long before there's a cessation of menses. And it is now well known that estrogen remains pretty high until just a few months before the formal menopause. In spite of continued estrogen availability, there's no progesterone. Ovulation is scant, periodic, and eventually is lost. But what we see as a result of this LH rise, I'm going to have a little trouble with this pointer, but there it goes, the stimulation of the residual theca in the now follicle-less ovary yields a very substantial testosterone level that is preserved for some years. And hence we see the expressions of failure to ovulate in dysfunctional bleeding, curiously vasomotor symptoms, which reveal some idea of what the physiology of vasomotor reactions are, persistent estrogen, mastalgia, PMS, and hirsutism. What this vasomotor reaction in the perimenopause, despite estrogen, suggests is that it is really a reflection of central nervous system pulsations of gonadotropin, very, very close in the hypothalamus to the temperature control center. So that even though therapeutic levels of estrogen counter vasomotor reactions, that doesn't prove the etiology. Going to the early postmenopause, I'm going to define that as the next 3 or 4 years after formal menopause. You're acquainted with the major reaction of vasomotor symptoms, and I use, and it's very, very qualitative, okay, a rule of quarters in this, about 25% of patients who are premenopausal will have hot flashes, noticeably during whatever periods they have. Some, perhaps a quarter of women, have such severe postmenopausal vasomotor reactions, they see a doc, and a quarter of those, not a whole lot, go on and have them for 3 to 5 years. So it's a real problem. There is a group that has hardly any, and usually these are obese individuals who have their own extragonadal source of estrogen in the aromatase inherent in adiposity. But the crucial thing is that the vasomotor reactions doesn't limit lifespan by 1 millisecond, but it influences quality of life to such detrimental degrees because of the domino effect, and it's principally related to sleep deprivation. And all of the emotional, behavioral, and psychological reactions to the menopause is largely, but not entirely, attributable to sleep deprivation. With sleep retrieval, most of those symptoms go away. But aside from those that are reproductive in orientation, there is a silent and accelerating burden, and that's the swift initiation of osteopenia, which within just a few years, depending upon the reserve of the bone that the women start with entering menopause, and leads to osteoporosis. And I put some data up there about the rate of trabecular bone loss each year, cortical bone loss each year. The effect of estrogen persists till about 15 years out, when the slope of decline in female bone becomes equivalent in the slope of decline to males. But beside that, the point is, untreated by 20 years, 50% of trabecular bone is lost. This is true of Caucasians, perhaps slightly less in African Americans and Asians, and 30% of total bone. So it's a real but silent problem until a catastrophic fracture occurs. Burdens of late menopause, postmenopause, are in the reproductive system. These are atrophic expressions of estrogen-dependent tissue. But what is real is the non-reproductive system burdens. There's continued bone loss, teeth included. There's an increase in dementia, thrombophlebitis. There's an increase in cancer, which we'll talk about in some detail soon, and the emergence of the metabolic syndrome and all of its elements with the postmenopause. Just to give you the gruesome details, here's a recitation of all of the financial and public health and personal health burdens that women face as a result of progressive, unrelenting osteopenia and osteoporosis. Here's age-related dementia, Alzheimer's disease. Here's this curious business that 80% of breast cancer occurs after menopause. And that portion that occurs premenopausally is the family-related, genetically-related breast cancers. But the thing that I will be talking a great deal about is this profound increase in cardiovascular disease events that occur in a precipitous, accelerated increase at around menopause. Now, it's clear that aging could be a really important factor in this, and I'm not going to argue that it isn't. But I will take the position that in the postmenopausal women, estrogen loss is a factor in the accumulating metabolic difficulties that occur. If you look at a group of women in which aging is not a factor, women who are under 40 years of age, who have untreated surgical menopause, a dwindling group of individuals, admittedly, but also untreated premature ovarian failure, who have normal karyotype. If you look at those, these guys have 3 times more osteoporosis, 2 times more cardiovascular disease, and, as you know well, a substantial decrease in breast cancer. The congenital loss of estrogen, either by absent receptor, absent FSH receptor, absent aromatase, that whole group, Grumbach reported this group of individuals, they have significant osteoporosis, insulin resistance, and early coronary artery calcification and cardiac events, all expressions of this emerging metabolic syndrome that appears to be in some part estrogen-related. So there it is. Aging is a factor for sure. Estrogen accelerates and makes the burdens more dramatic. But we didn't need that literature search. We were smugly convinced that it had to be estrogen-related because when we gave estrogen for relief of hot flashes and because we couldn't stop it because the hot flashes came back, a large group of women had a prolonged off-label use of estrogen, and by gum, in a variety of studies, you can't see them here. Most of them are fancy retirement colonies, but some of them in National Nurses Health Study. But in every instance, there was a roughly 50% reduction in coronary artery events in estrogen recipients. The same was true in osteoporosis, and there was even some data, again from these highly selected observational studies with respect to dementia protection. And then, of course, as Charlie Lockwood wrote in an editorial in some throwaway, the shot heard around the GYN world came in July when the WHI first was reported. And here's this avalanche, this cascade of reports, all of which, frankly, condemning the use of HRT in postmenopausal women. We were stunned. Surprised. And frankly, I will admit to you, personally, I was affronted by two things. The degree to which editorialists smugly, almost triumphantly, said to the docs that had been using this, me and others, and the pharmaceutical industry, gotcha. And I must say, having spent my entire life in support of healthcare for women, there was something in this triumphant display that hinted of misogynism. And I'm still convinced of that. But I was also insulted because it was clear that most of the people that wrote the editorials didn't read the papers. And I'll try to lead you through what made me feel that way in a moment. McDonald and Turgeon and others have commented on the basic science side, saying, okay, how come if steroids provide a biologic advantage prior to menopause, particularly in terms of coronary disease, cardiovascular disease, and if they cease in the unreplaced woman who is hypoestrogenic, either prematurely menopausal or untreated postmenopausal, why is it that an advantage paradoxically becomes a risk when these hormones are replaced therapeutically? That's the basic question. In the editorials that are still being written, they're kind of defensive now, press conferences and such. They say, well, all that other stuff that you guys depended on to lead you to management decisions was based upon observational retrospective studies. You all know those are flawed. You have to do prospective, randomized, blah. Well, in fact, when you look at the data and you look at the main criteria examined, the observational studies are absolutely similar in all respects to the WHI HRT results, except in one glaring entity, and that is in coronary heart disease, HRT recipients in WHI had a risk of roughly 30%, where every observational study except just a few showed a substantial protection. I won't go into it, but the data management board said we didn't expect that, and hence we were about to tolerate some breast cancer increase. But when there was no compensating heart protection, we stopped the study. Well, now let's examine the papers. Let's look very carefully. And the first thing we're going to do, let's look at the studies in the differences in the study populations. And I'm going to arrange this data in two columns. We're going to look at the largest observational study, 75,000 women looked at over 25 years, and compare those to the very carefully, prospectively selected cases and controls that were in the WHI study. And you bet this nurse's health study had a bunch of really pretty healthy ladies. They were young, most didn't smoke, and most were relatively thin. Just slightly overweight. But look at the WHI group. They were older. 50% of them had been or were smokers, and 40% of them were formally, definably WHO obese. So sure, there was a healthy recipient bias, but I submit there was an equally unhealthy recipient bias. So, yeah, I agree. There is a difference in the study population that could go either way. Differences of the timing of initiation of treatment. This is crucial. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on it because what we're examining here is whether or not there is a window of opportunity, hopefully wide, for interventions that might work in a preventive way as opposed to secondary efforts that only made things worse. And let's look at the data. The Nurses' Health Study started young. They started out because they were a historical chronicle of the evolution of HRT in the postmenopause. They started out with Premarin. It was the only real oral estrogen we had 40 years ago. And gradually, as certain data emerged with respect to endometrial hyperplasia and cancer, they had their progestin added in a sequential and then a combined way. Most of them got their hormones when they started having vasomotor reactions, either at menopause or at premenopause. And the dosage was pretty much standard at 0.625, but as you'll see, it was quite variable. The WHI women had either CE only if they had previous hysterectomy or PremPro. Forgive me, I perhaps should not mention a proprietary name, but it takes too long to say Premarin 0.625 and medroxyprogesterone acetate. But can I just say PremPro? Thank you. And you know what? This is an aside. Even those academic purists that I live with every day and was their dean, they don't know all these generic names either. They look them up, guys. They look them up. Oh, well. These ladies, almost all of them, either never took it, ever, or only a few, and very short duration. And the only time they started was when they entered the study. And the mean age is 62, 63. So some of them didn't take it for 20 years. Because the study went up to 79. And that's telling. Guys, if there's one slide here that you want to take home, not to your wives or to your husbands, it's this one. This is the WHI HRT study. Sure, there was no statistical difference amongst the various individuals by age, by decade age, but if you looked at the years after menopause, when they became formally hypoestrogenic, all of the coronary cardiac events occurred in women that were over 10 years out from menopause. And 3/4 of them were more than 20. Now, we know from a variety of studies, and I won't go through the list, that estrogen is good for the endothelium. And cartoonish condensation of all that information, it's a vasodilating and inhibiting of constriction. It is anti-inflammatory, and it reduces the degree to which activated macrophages can enter the endothelium. And if there are lesions, as invariably with our modern diets there will be some, there are several elements that reduce the risk of large plaques and unstable plaques, all related to estrogen working through estrogen receptor alpha. And when that's lost, you can't recover. And all of the good elements that estrogen might have induced, once this endothelium is infected, bad word, but get my point, here it is, all of the elements that lead to instability and possible hemorrhage and loss of this fibrous cap integrity, they're all worsened by the absence of estrogen effect. Finally, as you all know, what WHI epidemiologists didn't really consider was atherogenesis, a process that takes place over decades and only becomes clinically apparent after a substantial amount of disease is in place. And the scariest part of this, these are plaques, thickness of plaques in hearts that are prepared for transplant. These are young people who are already showing extensive atherogenesis as early as adolescence. We talked a bit of that this noon. So it's in place, and it's progressive, and it's relentless, and it's substantial before anyone ever knows anything about it. And if you remember, the coronary events, the cardiovascular events in large populations start out after menopause and skyrocket by age 65. Now, Clarkson is the vet Wake Forest that has been studying this story for a number of years in this wonderful primate colony that they have. And I'll reduce this slide to very simple facts. If you feed oophorectomized primate females an atherogenic diet, guess what? They get plaques, and lots of them, and they're thick. If you start estrogen replacement 2 years after that oophorectomy, there are significant plaques that progress. Estrogen doesn't work. But if you give the estrogen right at oophorectomy, there's a substantial reduction in plaques. And that persists despite the high atherogenic diet. So that once you lose the inhibition of progression that is estrogen inducible, estrogen can't recover it. So there's a window of opportunity that the WHI missed. And it not only missed, it picked up the adverse effect of hormone replacement on already established significant and unstable lesions. And I say that because when you look at the events and when they occurred, they all occurred in the first year and dwindled by the second year and disappeared, very much like the HERS study, which was blatantly a secondary prevention, 67-year-old on average individuals with previous coronary events and diabetes. Just the same kind of data. So you got to get estrogen in early for it to have any effect. And if you give estrogen late, it can only be harmful. Now, this timing business came under scrutiny. And thank goodness for Francine Grodstein and her colleagues at the NERSA's health study, Stanford, and others. Just recently reported here. They said, okay, let's look at the NERSA's health study and examine this issue of timing of onset. And we're going to accept the same criteria that WHI applied for primary prevention. They said they allowed as much as 4 to 6% of women who had a past history of disease. And they said they would look and discriminate between the nurses that took hormones within 4 years of menopause against those that waited for 10 years. Pretty much a replication of the WHI. And here's what they found. When they received estrogen or hormone replacement, either estrogen or E plus P, near menopause, there was a substantial reduction in events that was statistically significant. But when they waited 10 years or longer, that benefit was lost. The WHI countered, looked at their data, and by gum, when they looked at MI, coronary death, CABG, percutaneous, blah, blah, blahs, confirmed angina, in the first 10 years, there it was, a reduction in events that was statistically significant. Not so in the large cohort of their study that were beyond that age. It's right there in the data. Published here recently. So the first lesson is, you can use hormones in the first 10 years after menopause with safety. But the lesson number two is, you avoid those who are likely to have silent cardiovascular disease, i.e., those with any one, three of five expressions of the metabolic syndrome. I'm not going to get into the argument of whether there is such a thing as the metabolic syndrome, but there it is. Don't use it in these guys, because you're only asking to have them have the burden of acute, burdensome events. So now, we're looking at differences in outcome between the observed and the and WHI. We've looked at the populations. We looked at the window of opportunity, the timing of onset. What about the nature of steroids and how they were utilized? You all know that Premarin is roughly 50% equine estrogens. They are very powerful estrogens, and they are powerful because our detoxifying enzymes don't handle them so well. So they have not only higher effect, they have prolonged effect. The rest of Premarin is estrone sulfate, pretty much. It's a great drug, and we used it all the time, and with great benefit to our patients. But it's not a human estrogen. Provera isn't a human progesterone. It's a laboratory progesterone. And although progesterone gets metabolically cleared in one pass through the liver, not so with Provera. It sticks around and has very, very substantial effects. Now let's look at the value of Provera and compare the group that got in the WHI, that got HRT, and those that only had estrogen. And let's look at the events and say, where were the burdens accrued? Coronary, it was clearly related to the addition of progestin. Pulmonary embolism, clearly related to the addition of progestin. Breast cancer, clearly related to the addition of progestin. Hip fracture, same quality of reduction in risk, but no additional benefit. Stroke, both estrogen and Provera seem to have an influence on stroke, a negative influence. So in every instance, MPA either worsened or didn't add to the benefits. So why were we giving? Well, let's look at the estrogen. This is not just the WHI study, Chbilowski's. There's a whole bunch of meta-analyses or reanalyses. The whole world literature is represented here. And whereas estrogen-only recipients do have progressive increase over decades in their incidence of breast cancer, postmenopausal, that difference only becomes significant at around age 14 years out. Not so with the addition of Provera, where it is a precipitous incline. And that's not something new. We knew progesterone did wonderful things for breasts during pregnancy. The data on estrogen and breast cancer, Premarin alone, is interesting. When you look at the whole group, it was not statistically significant. But you look at the women who were 80% compliant, that is, they took their estrogen most of the time, they had a substantial reduction in their breast cancer incidence. Substantial reduction over the placebo. Well, you say these women had had babies, blah, blah, blah. Uh-uh. They had benefits, even though the placebo recipients had the same Gale score. And by the way, the placebo groups in both HRT and ERT were the same in terms of those qualities. So why are we giving Provera? Well, Alan Kaplan taught me that it has something to do with endometrial cancer. But look at the HRT data on endometrial cancer in the WHI study. No benefit. What are we doing here? Now I submit, these ladies were smokers and they were fat. So that had a lot to do with it. And I wager, though there's no way of recovering this information, that those individuals that had endometrial cancer on HRT were in the late postmenopause when they started their hormone and had probably 15 years of unabated estrogen without progesterone. And you know very well, better than I do, that once there's a atypia, there's no reversal with progestin. So lesson four is, wake up, guys. You're choosing between endometrial cancer and breast cancer? That's a layup. Don't do it. If you're worried, and NK means this is my clinical advice that I give to my colleagues every time they ask, before you start therapy, get a baseline endometrial biopsy. And if you don't want to do that, at least do an ultrasound, though you know that's really not quite like a biopsy. Then begin just ERT. And if there's no dysfunctional bleeding that results, just reassure you and the patient by a biopsy or ultrasound every year. But if there is any question, or if you're worried and your insurance carrier is worried, okay, give them some periodic progesterone. Not Provera. Insufficient dose and duration. We're talking 12 days. 200, 300, 400 for the more obese. And if you're really worried, and why no one takes this, well, I understand it. Who would ever want to have an IUD unless it was absolutely necessary? This is one way of getting around that whole subject completely. Putting an IUD in with levonorgestrel. Now let's look at dose. And I will submit to you that the doses that we use to counter hot flushes are not those that are necessary to preserve estrogen-dependent tissues after vasomotor reactions are gone. But you and I take some blame, mindlessly wrote renewals, okay, when we didn't have to. Because we now know that in bone, and in a moment I'll talk about stroke, exquisitely low doses of estrogen protect bone and avoid the burden of stroke. A number of studies have shown that very, very little estrogen preserves bone once it's stabilized, And Edinger has reported on a level of estrogen by patch that's not commercially available, it's so low, preserving bone integrity once it's stabilized. So that's a layup. But what about stroke? No difference between the HRT and the observational studies. And no difference either in the ERT arm. Let's go back to the nurse's health study. There was a small but still statistically significant group of women in that study who really only took 0.325, 0.3. And they looked at whether or not that reduction in estrogen had any effect vis-a-vis coronary artery events in against those that took 0.625. There was no difference. And furthermore, although estrogen and HRT at these doses had an increase in stroke that was substantial, on 0.3 alone, no increase. So dose matters. So the lesson is, after you think you've controlled hormones, vasomotor reactions, lower it very, very slowly and find the lowest dose that maintains the best health benefit versus risk ratio. And that's bone versus dyslipidemia. Now, finally, and this is this wonderful article in Science 2004, Turgeon and McDonald, sorry out there, in iPod land. The difference between taking stuff by mouth and transdermally or transvaginally is substantial. Because in the first pass absorption, the target that gets everything that you take by mouth is the liver. Liver is a big organ that does a lot of good things and generally protective things. We need it. But when you look at the oral use of estrogens or progestins, I think this is just estrogens. There is a substantial increase in angiotensinogen, a substantial increase in this marker of pro-inflammatory or inflammatory state, a marked change in IGF and sex hormone binding proteins of a variety, but most important, increased activated protein C resistance. Got that? None of these effects are seen by transdermal, transvaginal absorption. While there's a whole bunch of options in the polypharmacy that's available to you, and they work, I mean, giving SSRIs to a postmenopausal woman for hot flashes when she already has some difficulty with her sexuality is just madness. I haven't seen a patient. Now, admittedly, that's Manhattan. Upper East Side, fancy ladies. I haven't seen a lady on an SSRI that didn't have some appreciable reduction in libido when I asked. But clearly, everything hinges upon whether you can induce this kind of behavioral lifestyle change. But if you can't, and let's be realistic, here's what we do. What I say to my colleagues in their care of patients, for the perimenopause with these burdens, I try alternative medicines. I think there's a placebo effect. There probably is some direct effect. And that's great. But I mentioned a whole bunch of other things that you got on the slide. But increasingly, I am using low dose, that is 20 micrograms ethinyl estradiol and drosperinone monophasic continuously. Whether you give it seasonal, or just give monophasics without a pause, there's no physiologic benefit in menstruation. There's no secretion benefit, no excretory benefit. The endometrium exists purely as a vehicle for reproduction. For the early postmenopause, I give estradiol transdermally, and I admit it's as high as 0.1. twice weekly, and I do monitor by ultrasound or biopsy. Remember, I did a biopsy before I started this stuff, and I know that I can appreciably affect benefit in all these categories of the burdens of early postmenopause. And finally, for these burdens of the prolonged postmenopause, I use the lowest dose available patches that I can. I monitor estradiol after 3 months of equilibration, etc., and I'm looking for estradiol levels that are under 75 picograms per mil. And this makes sense. My colleagues don't make a diagnosis of thyroid disease or deficiency without a TSH. We don't treat diabetics without checking their glucose. Why just blindly write estrogens at fixed doses? And why not replace the physiologic way the ovary contributes to woman's health by secreting estradiol into the general circulation, which is just exactly what you're doing with transdermal, transvaginal. You're distributing it not first to the liver, but through cardiac output to the whole body. So these are my lessons. I try to avoid orals. I stick with estradiol if I can, and this is why I do it. Thank you very much for your attention. I'll take questions.
First, why don't we ask our guests, Sherilyn and St. Jacinta, if there are any questions. You need to unmute the mics. They should be able to.
Is Sugar Land a place where there's a lot of cane?
There used to be. There used to be a lot of sugar there, and now there's a lot of petrodollars. Okay, yes.
I have to tell you, my wife says I'm hard of hearing, but I think she just mumbles. But would you speak up anyway? I think in the under 50, if I espouse the utility of continuous monophasic oral steroids, I know that I'm not really concerned about spurious ovulations. I want to go as low as possible. But I like the notion of correcting that 25% that have hot flushes and the DUB that's inevitable. Before we had birth control pills, there were a million hysterectomies done in that age group every year. Birth control pills fix that, except where there's high mortgages and a lot of tuition bills. So, I'm very, very careful increasingly in, and I don't know who makes it, okay, drosperinone, because it is a unique progestin, at least in my reading in the literature. It has anti-androgen and anti-mineralocorticoid elements. Not great, but it's beneficial. So I like that mix. Okay, I would continue it into the mid-50s. I would use it until I felt comfortable in my relationship with the patient so I could start to taper that and prepare her for some hot flashes, but promise that I would come back at her with some estrogen-only patch. She doesn't need the progestin. And she sure doesn't need that progestin going through her liver.
Case?
Yes.
Sugarland Poly.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you. Question, you said estrogen early, but for how long would you carry it through? 10 years past the menopause, 20 years, or just continue?
Actually, that's a... I can answer that really crudely, like an actuary. I mean, the calculation would be how long before the patient died would I stop the estrogen? I know it takes 3 to 5 years for withdrawal of estrogen to have the resultant osteopenia catch up and make osteoporosis. But that doesn't help me either because... So I come down to it because I hope to live that long. I believe that prudent use of transvaginal or transdermal estrogen in the dose configuration that I'm discussing, monitored, as I have said... the endometrium, and monitored also by levels of estradiol in the venous blood, I think it is, based on the evidence that we have, safe to continue that for as long as the woman wants it.
Thank you.
Could you synopsize or sum up briefly, it's difficult, exactly what your thoughts are on the relationship between estrogen and or progestin?
The question is, stop the palaver, Doc. What is my reading of the information available on the relationship of estrogen and estrogen progestin and breast cancer? Let me start with the one very clear piece of evidence. The Connecticut State Pathology Library, a tumor registry really, has been recording diseases found in accidental deaths across the entire life cycle in the state of Connecticut. And in a report in the New England Journal in the early 1990s, I believe Welch is the author. I would have to look that up. It was clear that in silent form, 99% of thyroids had cancer in women who were 50. Men had 80% prostate cancer. 50% had ductal cancer. Not hyperplasia, not dysplasia. Ductal carcinoma in situ or worse. So you're starting out with disease that's there. So whatever you're going to do, you're going to promote it. It's how much you're going to promote and at what pace and with what countervailing benefit, sincerely determined and offered in informed consent. I submit, based upon all the data that we have, independent of route and dose, but I don't know the dose of effect of these low estradiol patches. But you have to say, based upon what you know, there will be progression, which over 30 years will represent a 30% increase. What does that mean? That means instead of 1 in 10, it'll be 1 in 13. Okay? Clearly also from the data that we have, when you add a progestin, you stimulate those mitoses. Unlike the endometrium, you stimulate those epithelial cells even further beyond what estrogen alone provides. So you get it earlier, sooner, rather, and clearly it's more advanced. WHI showed that. So there's no question. Having breasts is a, like guys with prostates, there's going to be cancer there if you live long enough. And if you take something, you're going to accelerate it because it's estrogen receptor positive and progestin receptor positive. And you have to just have that benefit-risk equation. And I submit the benefit accrues equally from estrogen only, and the risks are less.
Do you think the risks are less for progesterone than progestin?
The question is there a difference between various progestins and USP progesterone micronized by mouth? I can't answer that. Women who have had 15 or 20 pregnancies suggest that it's possibly safer. But there's something really screwy about that disease because the time of first birth is a whole lot of stuff that we don't understand. And even with clear BRCA1 and 2s, where you know there's a genetic flaw, if they're heavy, they get their disease sooner. And if they don't... If in the Ashkenazi Jew you have a woman who delays pregnancy, I don't know that any exists, but in those that are BRCA 1 and 2 that delay pregnancy, they get their breast cancer earlier. So it's endocrine influenced as well as genetically influenced. Please. Yeah. The question, if I can condense it to the point that I can address, is to what extent is there a burden from previous use? Okay. When you look at the world literature, you're disabled by one simple fact. We have a chronicle of dosage that has, over the decades, changed, right? So you don't know. It's very hard. There are subpopulations, younger girls who got those high dose contraceptives that had a small but real increase in breast cancer in an age group where there were almost no controls, right? So any one would have proven statistically significant. But the world literature would suggest that there isn't clinical disease that emerges. But obviously I'm not pretending by hesitating because I don't have that long-term data. I think it just makes clinical sense. And after all, guys, this is all we've got. I mean, we've got to take care of that patient and use our best judgment and forget about all this stuff. Well, not forget about it. You got to deal with it. It makes sense if you can lower the amount of estrogen hitting that breast, you're going to be better off. Your patient's going to be better off. I think we got someone from the... did I hear someone coming in from Sugarland or... Yes, please.
There are colleagues out there that are promoting natural products, estrogens, progesterone agents. What's your take on that versus what the medroxyprogesterone versus the other estrogens?
I commented earlier in this room, perhaps the mics, et cetera, whatever. I wasn't sure whether progesterone USP would be safer, but I would use it to protect against endometrial hyperplasia on an intermittent basis. I would just prefer that, but it means more pills for 12 or 14 days. I don't have a lot of data. I just got a clinical hunch about that. But let me answer the first part of your question. What could be more natural than estradiol? That's what I'm advocating. All the rest of this stuff is for people that eat leaves and twigs. If you believe that the ovary has some protective effect, and if you don't, well, I can't help you. But if you believe that the ovary protects the woman, as opposed to guys, men, well, then you got to believe it's that estradiol. And I think there's evidence for that. Did you shut off your mic? Sure. There are a lot of promotional gimmicks. I mean, just consider the food additive industry. That's an absolute embarrassment of exploitation. There is no data in support of that stuff. And I'm sure I'm offending some one of you out there that believe this is the true way to go. But there isn't data on this, guys. And it's a multi-billion dollar sham. Scam. Yes, please.
What's your feeling regarding shorter-term estrogen replacement therapy in the postmenopausal period and then a transitioning into VISTA or the bone and breast cancer prevention?
Let me be sure I understand the question. I'll repeat what I've heard. Is there some clinical advantage to our patients to simply use the estrogen to quell, thwart the vasomotor burdens, and then leave it to good health practices, diet and exercise, and not take any chances? Perfectly reasonable.
He said a CIRM.
How much have you used that particular drug, raloxifene?
I don't use these drugs.
Well, let me tell you, they do induce a fair amount of hot flushes.
Yeah,
I use raloxifene, excuse me for interrupting. I use raloxifene, and I advise my colleagues to do this, in those women where you do have a high risk of breast cancer, in her background or in her family. That's, I reserve for that use. A very, very, very good anti-resorption agent, almost as good as estrogen, but with no defined cardiac benefit and some vascular venous problems. So it's a very selected use. But thank goodness we have it. But I think the raloxifene prescriptions are going to dwindle now with the once-monthly anti-resorptives.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wonderful discussion.
Appreciate it. Thank you.